Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Well, I was thinking that this morning, today, was the first time that I can remember that everyone who signed up to sit this retreat came to the retreat. And nobody extra came, and nobody is missing. I can't remember a time like that before, and it's kind of, I don't know, I kind of find it satisfying that it's like that this morning. My theme today, my theme of my Dharma talk is, comes from, one of our ancient Zen texts, the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. And this song was written in the 9th century by Dungshan Myongji, who is one of the founders of our Soto Zen school in China. And it is a series of couplets. It's in the form of couplets, and all of which describe in one way or the other our practice, our immersive practice of sitting meditation, and describe various qualities and aspects of it. But it does so, of course, in its 9th century China milieu, so that the images that it uses and the references that are contained in it come from that ancient time. So often times we need some interpretation, and some, you know, scholars need to do some, have done some research to understand what the specifics of these images are referred to. So the line that I settled on, or came up, I think it came up, this came up in, for me, in our recent sesshin, this line from that poem is about an archer whose name is Yi, and the line goes like this: Yi, with his archer's skill, could hit a target at 100 paces, but when arrow points meet head on, what has this to do with the power of skill? So this story has a story, or these lines have a story behind them, a story that actually comes from pre-Buddhist China. Buddhism entered China somewhere maybe in the 5th century, 4th century, 5th century. And this story is before that. But it was, you know, a well-known story, apparently, and something that Dungshan thought his audience would, they'd get the reference. For us, not so much. But the story is that there was a master archer who may or may not have been named Yi. Some debate about that. But in any case, he had a student, and the student's name was Qi Cheng. And Qi Cheng studied with Master Yi for some years, And he thought he was getting pretty good. And somehow he got it into his head that if he could kill his master, then he, Chi Chung, would be the best archer in all of China. So Chi Chung and Yi had a showdown, a high noon showdown on a country road in ancient China, and Chi Chung shot the first arrow, and Master Yi returned his fire with another arrow, with his arrow, and the arrow points met head on, point to point, and fell harmlessly to the ground. That's the story. And the further part of that story is that Chi Chung had a great awakening to his delusion, of, you know, self. And as as selves often do, especially male selves, they want to be the best, right? They're interested in that. They like to compete and be the best. But he was enlightened to the deficiencies of this kind of understanding. And out of his great compassion, Master Yi took him back as a student and continued his training. So that's the story behind this, these lines in the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. So Dungshen has a question. You know, what, when arrow points meet, what has this to do with the power of skill? And I don't think, my feeling is that Dungshen was not trying, or didn't intend, with that question to denigrate the power of skill. In fact, I think he recognized the power of skill, both in archery, but also in his main subject. It was the main subject of this song he wrote, is our practice. The main subject is our sitting meditation, our immersive practice of sitting meditation. And I would think that Dungshen recognized that that arrow points meeting is, of course, beyond the power of skill, but nevertheless embedded in the power of skill. So in our sitting meditation, which is our main subject here, not archery, but our sitting practice, I think we recognize the power of skill. We realize or devote ourselves to many aspects of that skill, like sitting still and silent and upright, not mindful of not becoming bogged down in thinking, recognizing when thinking has arisen, seeing the arising of thinking, letting go of thinking, staying engaged in the body with our minds soft and concentrated, yet without an object, present, minds present and soft without an object. I don't know if Dogen invented this or not, but you know, sometimes we say about this sitting meditation that it's simply eyes vertical, nose horizontal. Nothing special. This is, you know, this is the inheritance of all human beings. Eyes vertical, nose horizontal. Nothing special. Yet, to sit upright and still in the midst of this nothing special, and let it be nothing special, but let it be my committed sense of presence, mindful awareness, moment by moment. I think all of us who recognize that ideal understand how much skill it takes to actualize that kind of, that ideal, that kind of silence and stillness and presence, and not being bogged down, not staying bogged down in thinking. So, I don't think that Master Dumshan, was denigrating at all when he said, "What has this to do with the power of skill?" I don't think he was denigrating skill. I think what he was saying is there's something beyond skill. There's some completion or mastery that is embedded in skill and goes beyond skill. And that completion we call that Buddha, or we call that Buddha nature. Some power that is not of our own doing, being met by a power that is beyond our doing. We fully express ourselves, we do sitting meditation, and sitting meditation is completed and realized by our not doing, by Buddha, the master of not doing. So, I didn't know how much I could say about this topic. So I thought, oh, I remember there's a book. There's a book, a very classic Zen book that I have never read. And I decided to read that book. And I bet some of you have read this book. It's called Zen and the Art of Archery. How many people have read that book? Jody, Rollin, Cody, John. Well, I commend this book to you, actually. This book it was always kind of on my, someday I'll read that book, that kind of list, But I had never read it, and I quite thoroughly enjoyed it. It's full of Dharma gems, and anyway, it was published in 1948, but it's based on It's based on the experience of a German philosopher named Eugen Herbel, who went, he was professor of philosophy in Germany, and he was invited to go to Japan to teach philosophy from university there. And he had a lifelong interest in mysticism, and he was just thrilled to death, apparently, to get this invitation to go to Japan and practice. And he thought, oh, when I go to Japan, I'm going to be able to find a Zen teacher, and I'm going to be able to practice Zen. And as it happened, when he did get to go to Japan, and he did get this teaching position, but he could find no one, no Zen teacher who was willing to take him as a student in the 1920s. You know, this was the Western, there weren't very many Western Zen students, maybe none, I don't know, in the 1920s. Anyway, he couldn't find a Zen teacher to take him on, but it was suggested to him that he might study one of the Japanese arts that was influenced and sort of birthed in the womb of Zen. And of course, there are a number of arts like that. Calligraphy is one, Japanese calligraphy, flower arranging, and there's actually Bushido, which is sword play, or sword, and also there's archery. There's a form of archery that is ceremonial in nature, not intended to simply be a demonstration of skill or something like, a trick archer who can, you know, do various things like make arrow points meet in midair, but actually a form of archery that was birthed in Zen practice, apparently, and is intended to be performed as a ceremony, as an expression of a kind of a religious expression. So he was lucky enough to find a teacher, and this teacher's name was Kenzo Awa, and he had a colleague at the school where he was teaching who could translate for him, who agreed to assist him in his studies of archery, and he went. And the teacher accepted him. And the really interesting thing is that after reading this book, I really felt that the book, there's no evidence of this at all, but I felt like the book could have been conceived as an answer to Dungshan's question. You know, when arrow points meet head on, what has this to do with the power of skill? And how should we understand? How can we be made to understand the gap, the divide, if you will, between skill and mastery? What is it? What is it? What quality is brought to our practice such that the gap between skill and mastery is bridged? So this book details, Herigel, took this seriously. He had a 6-year apprenticeship with his master, coincidentally equal to the time it's told that was that elapsed from when Buddha left the palace until his enlightenment. It's said to be 6 years. Coincidental. But in any case, he took his studies with Master Awa very seriously, and the book goes into quite a bit of detail about his struggle to, you know, do this. I mean, you know, it doesn't seem like much of a thing, right? To grab a hold of a bow, pull back the bowstring, and let it go. But in 6 years of apprenticeship, he struggled mightily to realize the art of archery, the ceremony of archery, to understand archery from within, you know, as a personal and other than personal expression of being fully present, really being fully present and alive in the performance of this ceremony. So after some years of struggle, and at first in his apprenticeship, they didn't shoot at a target. All he was asked to do was learn how to hold the bow. And it's not just like we would think like this. Apparently, you raise you raise the bow up above your head, and I don't know if it comes down later. I couldn't quite tell that, but in any case, the bow is made of bamboo, and it's very strong, and it appears to take a great deal of strength to pull back the bowstring. But as you might imagine, the master made this look completely effortless. But for the student, it seemed like it was impossible, that it took so much effort. And then when he would pull back the bowstring, his hand back here and arm would start to tremble. Whereas the master just pulled it back and no movement at all, you know. And then there was a great deal of difficulty about releasing the bowstring, which is not meant to be done intentionally. It's meant to happen. It's meant to happen. It's meant to be done without self-consciousness, without intention. And so I hope you can see a relationship to our sitting practice in that. But in any case, I'll say more about that. But he came to a point in his training, Yarago came to a point in his training where after several years of just practicing, you know, pulling back, and he would release the arrow, but all they would shoot at was a sandbank, and there was no instruction or nobody said, you know, hit such and such a thing with your arrow. It was never like that. It was just learn how to pull back the bow string, how to hold the bow, how to pull it back, and never any instruction about how to hit anything. But after several years, he was invited finally to shoot at a target. And as often as he tried to hit this target, which the master could hit without seemingly making any special effort, his arrows, Harrigal's arrows, always fell short. He could never reach the target. And he became after who knows how long, you know, months of this, it doesn't detail how often he met with the master or whatever, but after some time, he was becoming very frustrated, and the master sensed this, and I want to read you this. It's interesting in this book because you know that excuse me. You know that in the 1920s, you know, Herigel did not have a tape recorder, or, you know, some little pocket tape recorder to record what his master's instructions were. But he, throughout the book, he tells us what the master said, and you know, puts the words, you know, and you have to wonder, you know, if the master really said it that way, you know, or this was just Herigel's kind of remembering of it. But nevertheless, this is what he says the master said about his the failure of his arrows to carry. Your arrows do not carry because they do not reach far enough spiritually. You must act as if the goal were infinitely far off. I recommend that for your sitting practice. Act as if the goal is infinitely far off. For master archers, it is in fact a common experience that a good archer shoots further with a medium strong bow than an unspiritual archer can with the strongest. It does not depend on the bow, but on the presence of mind, on the vitality and awareness with which you shoot. In order to unleash the full force of this spiritual awareness, you must perform the ceremony differently, rather like a good dancer dances. Instead of reeling off the ceremony like something learned by heart, it will then be as if you were creating it under the inspiration of the moment, so that dance and dancer are one and the same. By performing the ceremony like a religious dance, your spiritual awareness will develop its full force. So, I wondered why the teacher would use this. I was puzzling about this metaphor or simile, I guess you'd say it's a simile, comparing this art of archery, this ceremony of archery, to a religious dance. And I think it came to me, anyway, that a religious dance is always, you know, it's meant to be, it has a fixed form. It's always meant to be done in a same way so that people can see that whatever the dance is supposed to conjure up, it's meant to be conjured in the same way each time it's done. But if the dancer gets too, you know, if the dancer is simply trying to replicate the form, just simply trying to act out the form, the dance won't be a living dance. It won't have the full expression of, you know, the dance will not reach far enough spiritually, just like Herigel's arrow did not reach far enough spiritually. The dancer has to embed themselves in the form and yet express themselves and allow themselves to be danced by the dance and And if a dancer is being danced by the dance, you can see that. You know, you can see that their animation is different than if they were just reeling off the form of the dance. And I just think this has relevance, you know, this story about the bow and not being strong enough and your arrows do not reach far enough spiritually. I think it has relevance to our sitting practice. We make, you know, I hope we're all making a strong effort in our sitting practice. It's important. It's important to make a strong effort. But we can't. It can't be all effort. It can't just be effort. It can't just be trying. In other words. And I think, I've told this story before, but one of my first Zen friends, who was influential on me starting to practice, we went to a sesshin together early on, and this person was very, very determined person. Very strong personality. And what happened in the sesshin was that he tried so hard, so he made such a strong effort that he gave himself a migraine headache, and he had to drop out of the sesshin, and we didn't know where he was. He went off, and he it turned out he crawled into the back of his car and went to sleep and didn't return to the sesshin. Now, I guess this was toward the end of the sesshin. And what I think about it when I think about this story is I think my friend thought, I don't have a strong enough bow. I need a stronger bow. And so he was putting give me a stronger bow, and then I can reach the target. You know, let me put, you know, maximal effort in here. And I think that kind of determination, well, it just overdoes it. You know, we have to have. Oh, no, we don't have to do anything. I always say that. But, you know, if we have faith in the practice, then we can make a determined but gentle effort in our practice. You know, determined effort, yet a gentle effort. Because our faith tells us that if we make this effort, we will be met. Our arrow will be met. And this we experience in practice will teach us that our effort will be met. And when our effort is met, you know, sometimes we think, what was all that for? You know, what was all that hard work I was doing for? It's so easy. It's so self-evident. It's. I'm just carried by the practice. What was all that struggle about? But still, the struggle was necessary. The struggle was important. The thorough engagement in the practice was worth it. Was the basis for being met. There are, as I said, there's a number of Dharma gems in this book, and I do recommend people reading this book. It's of its time and place, but it's an interesting book, and there's one of the things it includes was a demonstration by the master that's very reminiscent of the story of Arrow Point's meeting. But the main principle that the master, or that Terrible thinks that the master is trying to convey, is that the point of the archer's the real target of archery is the archer. The archer hitting him or herself. And he has a quote about this, and I'm going to read. It's in quite elevated language. It's the way he talks, or the way he wrote it. The Japanese masters understand this contest of the archer with himself. For them, the contest consists in the archer aiming at himself, and yet not at himself, and thus becoming simultaneously the aimer and the aim, the hitter and the hit. Or, to use some expressions which are nearest the heart of the masters, it is necessary for the archer to become, in spite of himself, an unmoved center. Then comes the supreme and ultimate result. Art becomes artless. Shooting becomes not shooting. The teacher becomes a pupil again, the master a beginner, the end a beginning, and the beginning perfection. This, I think, is a little lofty. The language is a little lofty. I'm not sure that the masters would use such a flowery, expression. But the fundamental point is to embed oneself in the skill and dance the ceremony of the skill. It's to be embedded in the ceremony without any other concern. What happens beyond our enactment of the skill is not our concern. We have famous expression, to study Buddhism is to study the self. This is our effort. We make that effort. We make an effort to study the self. The expression goes on to say, to study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be met and confirmed by myriad things. Well, those beyond the study, those things beyond the study, forgetting the self, being met and confirmed by the myriad things, that's not up to us. That's not our business, as Myo would say. We just study the self. And we, based on that self-study, and based on hints, the little hints we get some hints that encourage our faith that we will be met by the practice. We will be met by the master on the road. And he will shoot his arrow. And our arrows will meet. So I haven't talked about, he has a lot of discussion in this book about his struggle with releasing the bowstring. And this becomes like sort of like his mu koan or something. It's the thing that he cannot find, you know, this point of releasing the bowstring without intention or only as a result of there being too much tension, so much tension that he just has to let it go. Neither of those are right. Right? So it's you know, and he actually comes up with a scheme to try to like trick the master into thinking that he found the way to do it, right? And then master recognizes this and actually kicks him out of the study. And then he has to beg and have someone come and intercede to take him back, and he has to make, you know, I'm so sorry. I tried to trick you. And finally, he does have some success. But his difficulty is, and he talks about this, his difficulty is with the waiting. His difficulty is with waiting for the release. At the point of maximum tension, not giving in to the tension, still not self-consciously releasing, but just waiting at this point of maximum tension for the release. And he talks about this quite a bit, and it reminded me, this is how I end this talk, it reminded me of a poem, or part of a poem, that is by T.S. Eliot, it's quite on point, if you will, with this theme of this talk and this issue of waiting. And this poem is called Wait Without Hope. I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope, for hope would be hope for the wrong thing. Wait without love, for love would be love of the wrong thing. There is yet faith, but the faith and the love and the hope are all in the waiting. Wait without thought, for you are not ready for thought. So the darkness shall be the light, and the stillness the dancing. Couldn't. T.S. Eliot wrote that for this talk. That's how I felt when I read it again. I thought, wow, right on point. Thank you very much. It's time for Kenyan, but maybe you want to ask some questions or make some comments. I don't need to be one-sided. Yes, Larry.
You're not surprised that I want to talk.
Right.
Thank you, Jim. That's a very good... Can you hear me?
Yes.
And I appreciated your talk. I wholeheartedly buy your description of the arrow points meeting as effort meeting non-effort, in a sense. And yet I had a different, you know, in my mind, and I've not done any studies on Savitch or listened to any teachers, but just in my mind, the arrow points meeting is like such a graphic representation of duality turning into non-duality, which is totally consonant with the what you're explaining, effort meeting non-effort, and you know, so but I hadn't given thought to it, but the visual of those arrow points meeting is very strong to me. From two becomes one when the arrow points meet. There's no two tips anymore. It's just one. So, and then since the idea of jukeboxes comes up now and then, and when you described it as pulling back and having to wait, I think you said the waiting is the hardest part. You don't know the Tom Petty song? The waiting is the hardest part.
I don't know that part.
You don't know that one.
I know. Cupid, draw back your bow. I know that one. And let your arrow flow.
Would anybody on the other side like a microphone?
Just to say, in response to your comment, Larry, that pretty much what you just said is conventional understanding, or not, I don't want to say conventional, but usual understanding of arrow points meaning, like relative and absolute, you know, meaning. Yeah.
Thank you.
Should be green. If it's green, it's good.
There it is. Okay, I just put the button. Thank you. I like the comment about effort meeting non-effort. That was interesting. You know, you had the phrase thorough engagement, which felt right. And what doesn't feel right is striving, struggling, having a goal, needing to meet a goal. I mean, that's where the migraine comes from. It's a struggle as opposed to thorough engagement.
Yeah, Herigel is brings up the goal quite often. He and I have the same reaction, you know, like, Be careful about, because, I like this, there was this phrase in here, and about the dancing, but in any case, I can't find it, I know, it was about the unmoved center.
Yeah.
It was about the unmoved center. And he says something, he says, like, in spite of yourself, become an unmoved center. I really like that, because I would say like this: in spite of all your wiggling, in spite of all your wiggling, become an unmoved center. So there, that takes both things into account, right? It takes the fact that, you know, there's wiggling going on. You know, we're wiggling all the time, but yet we can hold we can acknowledge that, we can be kind to that, and yet we can have a goal of becoming an unmoved center. We can have an intention to become an unmoved center, and I think we can hold both those things at once. We can allow both those things at once. That we want. There's something in us that wants, that really, really wants this unmoved center that cares for that and wants to be met by that and wants to experience that, and yet we hold both things that we're wiggling all the time. But in spite of that, we're holding this intention. So I don't know if I totally, really, ultimately accept a teaching of no goal. So maybe it's a problem, but I think we can have. I would never call it a goal, really, but I would call it a wish or an aspiration. I would certainly call it that.
There's a difference between
goals
and aspirations.
Mm-hmm. Rosie has a point.
Do you have time for one more?
Yeah, sure. One more.
There's a saying that I've heard, thank you for your lecture, the 6-inch drop where it goes into your heart.
Hmm.
Where you let go of your thinking and you open your heart, your willingness to open your heart to all of that. But when you read the poem, so I was interpreting like opening my heart, love vibration, right? Like harmonious vibration. But then when you read the poem and it said it's not love, and I was on a walk with a friend yesterday and we were talking about love, how the responsibility of love. Like it's great, but it's work and it's a practice and it's just, it is. But the harmony, the vibration, and the willingness to be able to love your practice, to come here to sit, to open your heart. That's kind of what I've taken away from the beautiful lecture today.
Well, the poem is a little more subtle than that, I think, because it doesn't say without love. It just says, you know, he says, for love would be love for the wrong thing. So he's saying, you know, don't try to pin down your love exactly. Be careful. I think he's been saying, be careful about your love, that it not be grasping. Exactly. It's so easy for love to be grasping. So I think he's just saying, well, from a Buddhist standpoint anyway, be careful. You know, he wasn't a Buddhist, but be careful about love. Let it not be grasping love. And then it can really be love.
Quick comment, if I may.
Yes, you can make a quick comment.
Yeah, so going back to the sashin, if you recall, it was me that brought up the two arrows meeting.
Mm-hmm.
When I was complimenting your and Doralee's lectures on the Satipatthana and how you didn't coordinate your lectures together. And what I was getting at that point was if you listen to Doralee's talks and your talks and containers, they could have been viewed as, you know, almost radically different in a way, different style,
mm-hmm.
different approach. But in that container, there was just something else that made them perfectly complementary and beautiful for me. And that's what I meant by the arrow points meeting. Do I have the right understanding?
And the something else was you. The something else was your mind.
I forgot about the best part.
The best part. The best part. You know, the target is always himself. That's what the master says, or that's what Hergel understood. The target of this whole practice is myself. And he also says, and not myself. So he completes that picture. Myself and not myself. Which is, what is not myself? Not myself, everything. Everything is not myself. And is myself.